It is so good to be back, to be among like-souled individuals. Let me tell you, it's mutual. It really is. So I'm very touched that you've asked me back to share with you a different perspective in the book. I imagine being like-souled individuals, you probably did a few of the things I did. Reading the book, I laughed, I cried, I sat in silence, I was overwhelmed by certain sentences. Others, I thought, I really admire this woman. She's really gifted, very courageous in what she's done. So I'd like to begin with another courageous woman in our history, a woman who knows what it means to live a life of transformation. Doctor of the Church, mystic, St. Teresa of Avila. This is a lengthy poem that she entitled, I Loved What I Could Love. I had a natural passion for fine clothes, excellent food, and lively conversation about all matters that concern the heart still alive, and even a passion about my own looks. Vanities. They do not exist. Have you ever walked across a stream stepping on rocks so not to spoil a pair of shoes? All we can touch, swallow, or say aids in our crossing to God and helps unveil the soul. Life smooths us, rounds, perfects, as does the river, the stone. And there is no place our beloved is not flowing, though the currents force you may not always like. Our passions help to lift us. I loved what I could love until I held him. For then, all things, every world disappeared. That's a mystic. She gets it. We're here today because a courageous, humble, loving woman dared to put into words her experience of confronting reality. You see, all of the different religious avenues, their goal is to try and make sense, to lead us on the journey to reality. This is what Teresa is talking about. But most of us don't live in reality. We play games. Thomas Merton called it living with the false self. Call it what you may. It's not discovering who we are until finally, often it's late in life or after we've been traumatized, we realize, this isn't who I am. So we've been highly stressed or traumatized. In a way, as the mystics point out to us, we should say, thank God. Because it strips us, it liberates us from the falsities of our life. To recognize that all this vanity is coalesced. This is why, indeed, we are invited by the mystics to see it is time. It is time to go deep. It is time to drink more fully of the wells, not of our comfort, but the wells of what we call the divine sustenance that's immersed in the fullness of reality, and yet not limited to reality. Father Karl Rahner, very noted theologian, some call him most important theologian since Thomas Aquinas, said that in this 21st century, we'll either become mystics or we'll devolve into becoming fundamentalists. And we see exactly the result of that in light of the violence around us. Is that, let's face it, many of us don't want to grow up. Because to grow up as a human being means to grow down into the depths. We even say it, those of us who are Christian, in our Apostles' Creed. Jesus descended into hell. Unfortunately, most people see that as a literal reality rather than a metaphorical way of saying the only way to ascend is to first descend in the depths of our humanity. Because that's where we discover the transcendent reality of God. That in God's great wisdom and great love for us, God has embedded God's self in the depths of our humanity. And so it's only when we drink deeply of the fullness of our humanity, drink deeply of the reality, we find God. We live in historical time. Church historians, secular historians point out to us that we are caught betwixt and between two different ages. We are leaving the age of nationalism and moving into the age of globalism, more of a unitive consciousness. And therefore, like all previous ages, there will be turmoil, there will be violence. And typically, this time betwixt and between is about 50 to 60 years. Thankfully, we're nearing the end of this time. It began in the 60s. These historians, in their wisdom, refuse to be prophets. They speak from their place of study and research and reflection and say, all we know is that it will not be the same as it was in the 50s and 40s and 30s. It will be different. What will it look like? Well, we have glimpses, but none of us really know what it's going to be. This is why different writers on this realm speak about, we are in the midst of a dark night, but unlike anything we've experienced before. It's being called a dark night of the cosmos. It's larger than any individual dark night. It's larger than any human dark night as a community of beings. It's a dark night of the cosmos. That literally, the whole cosmos is inviting us to look beyond, to trust the reality deep inside. That as we know, all well know, that after every winter is always spring. After every darkness, every night, there's always the rise of a new sun. And so it is in terms of the interior life. This is faith, my friends. To believe, which means to stand under and in. To walk in that reality. So again, it's to trust that journey. That we are not alone. That there's a presence. There is a love beyond all telling. That helps us, that escorts us, that journeys with us. And points out to us ways and means of being able to encounter this great love. We get glimpses of it from time to time. An unexpected smile. An insight that holds us. An image that just grabs us. I have a 92-year-old aunt. She's the only surviving member of her generation on my mother's side. She is a woman religious and has been for 75 years. This will be her wonderful Jubilee year celebration. But I am so impressed with the way that she's approaching life. She has a lot of time on her hands, and believe it or not, at 94, she still has a job, a ministry, and that is caring for her other elder sisters in the religious community that she belongs to. And what she loves to do is to send out these wonderful email blasts with little quips and sayings, as well as lovely pictures of creation. The type of things that just kind of make your day. But she always reminds me, just by this great gift, that the way into God, or the way, better to say it this way, to wake up to God, is to look around you. So often, we can depend on belly button gazing. And that invariably is looking at what's wrong with me, what's wrong with mine, my life, etc. And wherever you put that local word, you include perhaps others. But as Teresa of Avila, as Catherine of Siena, so many of the great mystics across religious lines point out to us that we need to move beyond our old models of religion, of faith, of spirituality, and dare I say, life experience. We all know this intellectually, but when it happens, we seem to forget it. And that is that the news media, as a profession, focus on what we would call bad news. Now, this could be either secular or it could be religious media. They do the same thing. You know why? It's because it feeds on gossip. And we can all give ourselves into gossip. In other words, how can I put down this person or this group so I feel better? One older woman said to me just the other day, I must admit, The reason I would watch the news is so I could be filled with more ammunition to hate the other person. That was her quote. A woman in her 70s. She said, "Thank God I woke up and I realized something's terribly wrong here." A woman of great faith. So what she did is she cut way back on watching the news, because it was feeding into a part of her that she didn't want to feed anymore. So here's a little ditty that perhaps might help you, especially in your interactions with what I call the super religious, is that we need to move from a behave, believe, and belong model of religion to a belong, believe, behave model. What that means in practicality is, for example, the Catholic context, you don't tell people how to behave, especially adults. And then at the very end say, "Oh, by the way, when you behave, then you can come to communion." Jesus never said that. And in so many of our parishes, our church, our meaningful prayer groups, we do that. "Sorry, you can't come here until you dress right, say the right things, memorize this, get your marriage fixed up, whatever it may be." Jesus never did that. He said, "Come. Come as you are. That's how you are loved." And so that's why we're here this morning, because we've got a lot of issues too. Unfinished, some of them unrecognized, unresolved, but that's how God loves us. Slowly that love works on us, and son of a gun, if over many years, we begin to realize that now we're behaving better. C.G. Jung said it beautifully, and it's this, that we rarely solve our problems. Rarely. We tend to outgrow them. We outgrow them because we realize we're loved. This is why St. Augustine, in his second half of life, said, "Love and do what you will." So I want to proclaim clearly the kerygma to you, so that you can't say you never heard the good news. It's very simple. Is that God loves you as you are. You don't have to change anything. You don't have to do anything differently. God just deeply and truly loves you. There you go. Isn't that great? So that you can think of God as like Mr. Rogers. God is in your neighborhood. Okay? So God doesn't love you because you're good. God loves you because God is good. You see how we've turned it around? Your life is not about you. It's about God. And that's what the mystics keep trying to tell us. They tell us in so many different ways. And then when they get tired, they just smile and say, "Well, someday you'll figure it out." But we rarely figure it out from the mind. It's from the heart. It's the experience of being loved. When you have this sense that you are a part of this large picture called the cosmos, called creation, you finally realize, wow, it isn't about me. So this is why when you stand on the edge of the Grand Canyon, or you're in Montana looking at this huge sky, or in the middle of the desert looking up at night at all the stars, you just go, and nothing comes out. This sense of awe and wonder. And why the ancient questions come back to you like, "Well, who am I in the midst of this? I'm not as big, as important as I thought I was. And yet, I'm really important, very important to God." So what we're talking about through Mirabai's wonderful book is what Richard Rohr calls the second half of life approach. It's very different than the first half. The first half is about getting our act together. The second half of life is about letting it fall apart again. And as we look around the room, our bodies are falling apart, aren't they? They aren't working the way they used to. And that's the way God has planned it. Unfortunately, our own ego hasn't gotten the word. And so we're still holding on, trying to fix and straighten out and move. And if we get frustrated doing it for ourselves, we start doing it with our children, our grandchildren, our neighbors, and our friends. And God says, "Oh, for God's sake, just let it go." That's why one of the most important things that the mystics teach us is to practice surrender. To practice surrendering. To allowing yourself to dissolve into God. To allowing yourself to become one with all that is. And there are so many countless ways and means to God, because God is multilingual, multi-experiential, multi-dimensional, multi-imaged. Just when you think, oh, I've found the perfect image, the perfect experience, it doesn't work for anyone but you. That's God's plan. Because God presents to us many, many countless opportunities, times, places, for us to step into the experience and to enjoy it. I admit, there were a few moments where I was frustrated with the rain driving here. But as I stepped out to use the restroom and to fill up the car with gas, this feels great, thank you, Lord. It's not pouring, it was a nice mist. I'm enjoying this, thank you. That's the type of kiss that God gives us throughout every single day. If we're so focused on objects or projects, we lose sight of the big gift. And this is why we're often turned back to children, or to the mystics, or to people who somehow or other for a moment see it, or get it, or hear it. The mystical path is for everyone. The mystical path is for everyone. It's experienced differently. So for those of us who follow the Christian faith, we would say it this way, is that every day the call, the invitation, is to experience the Christ somehow, somewhere. And the Christ project is much bigger than you think. It's not just the historical person of Jesus. It's God is embedded, which means, another way to say it in popular language is, there's meaning in everything. God is embedded in reality. So if the mystical path is for everyone, how are you experiencing it? So let me give you an example. I'd like you to think back to a time in your life where you lost your sense of yourself as being separate from another human being. I'm going to give you a few examples. It might have been when you went to a concert, or a sports outing, or when you were making love, or you were listening to music that just moved you. Perhaps you had your eyes closed, or it was an experience in creation where you felt one with nature. Maybe you're with a wild animal. But just think for a moment where you lost your experience of being a separate self. Would you turn to the person next to you and share that experience? Share that experience. Okay, thank you for sharing. So the experience that you shared was God teasing you into the mystical realm. This is what we call an ordinary mystical experience. Think of what Teresa just said in her poem. They are gateways, windows, into the experience with the great love. Now here is the challenge. St. Ignatius of Loyola warned us about this, is that as we mature in the spiritual life, it's not so much the temptation towards the bad or towards evil. Oh, no, no. Rather, is a temptation to give yourself to other goods. Is that the goods get in the way, the many goods get in the way of the best way. The best way, the great love. We forget the lover behind all of these loving things. They're all meant to move us, to point us, to direct us in the way of the great love. So if the mystical path is for everyone, why are we having such a hard time finding it? It's because it's like going to the ocean. You're blessed by living here in Santa Barbara and its environs because the ocean is right there. But how many of you have actually swum in the ocean? You know? Well, there you go. We got a few hands. How many of you have explored it? For example, diving deeply. Some of you have. Okay. Snorkeling. Okay. Good. Okay. So there's different ways of exploring the ocean. But if you're the type of person that, I don't like that salt water on my body. It feels so uncomfortable. Or the sand, I stay away. So that's kind of like the way we can approach our relation with God. We kind of dip our toe in the edge of the ocean and say, oh yeah, I've been to the ocean. Okay? And I hate to say this about my fellow clergy persons, but sometimes we clergy haven't even been in the depths. But we do a lot of talking about it, a lot of writing, you see. But the mystical experience is experiencing it for yourself. No one can do it for you, no matter how much they love you. So it's the invitation. So God teases us with these ordinary mystical opportunities. When you lose your sense of separateness and you realize, wow, I feel connected here. I feel joined, like a mother and child, especially a mother and in utero child. This intimate, deep connection, here is the key. Go deep in one tradition. Now, Mirabai is very, very unusual. What she did when she suffered, she recognized she had to find something larger, a bigger container to hold her suffering. And thank God, she stumbled upon different religious outlets. But it's obvious she gave many, many hours, thousands of hours of attention and humble learning to be able to get what she received, to be able to experience what we're just talking about. And that's the idea of what we're to do. Let me tell you a story. When I was getting certified as a spiritual director many, many years ago, the school that I went to asked us all to choose a prayer partner between the other participants. And they strongly recommended that we men choose a woman, a woman choose a man, to be able to deal with the gender difference. And so my partner was a woman named Wendy. And I remember one morning we were sitting listening to a talk together, and we were seated in the second row. This woman started by saying, when I was 4 years old, my father committed suicide. And that's pretty much what we all do. It's like, oh boy. And what she did is she told the story of what she did as a response to this deep, deep pain. She turned to God and she said, you took my daddy, now you're going to have to be my daddy. And so she entered her imagination, and when all of her girlfriends were doing things with their father, she imagined God doing these activities with her. And now this is her speaking. She said it helped her to avoid any of the undue necessity of facing the pain of relating to all men in that regard. She said, thank God, I'm happily married. She gave us a whole list of things that were happening in her life. Now, I'm sure at some psychological level, there are some parts that were missing. But she used as an example the power of imagination. Next to me, Wendy was weeping the entire time during her talk. Because we're in the second row, I didn't want to turn to Wendy and say, what's going on? Waited until it was over, and I turned to her and said, so what's up? And through sob, she said, that's my story. Except my dad didn't commit suicide. He was killed in a car accident when I was 4. And what I ended up doing is I kept looking for my daddy in the arms of other boys, other young men. She said, thank God I married to a wonderful man, but I really, really suffered a lot of pain. So this is the type of thing that we're talking about. Human pain and suffering happens to all of us. But what do you do with it? Religion teaches us what to do. And that's what Mirabai learned. As you read carefully through the book, you heard her story, and it was only a part of her pain. But what she did and how she embraced her body, her soul, her spirit, she embraced all the things that hurt her, and slowly over life, it was transformed. So it's meant to be for us. If you have the time, the energy, the prompting by God to do it that way, that's fine. However, if you don't, I would highly recommend what she implies, and that is, choose one tradition and go deep all the way. You probably remember the story of Thomas Merton. Early on in his own life, he decided that he wanted to go and learn Zen Buddhism. And so he found a master to train him and work with him for many years. Then one day, his master said, "Thomas, you're too much of a Westerner. Go home and practice your Catholic faith." And that's when he really began to go deep in the Christian vessel, the Christian well of going deep. So it is for us. So for those of you who are Catholics and are a bit worried about this, we say and believe that when you go deep in your faith, you can choose practices, you can choose programs, if you want to use that, you can choose books, teachers, from other religious backgrounds and experiences to help you in that journey. But it's always to go deep into your own tradition. This is why mystics can talk to each other across the religious divides, but they can't talk to people in their own tradition. Because we write them off as, "Oh, crazy," or, "Oh, don't listen to that person." You know? But they can understand each other because they're talking a language of experience. St. John of the Cross said, "The language of God is the experience of our life." God speaks to us through that experience. So religious truths can direct us, but it's only applied spirituality that can assist us in this task. So I'm going to state a paradoxical truth to be a bridge builder here with you. From the perspective of the human soul, the psychological task and the spiritual task are one and the same. The language is different. Some of the practices might be different. The ways and means might be different, but it really is, from the perspective of the soul, the very same thing. And the more mature that we get on the journey, the more you realize that by experience. So let me give you an example from the Christian perspective. Embedded within every liturgical experience, what that means is embedded in every public form of worship, are four great truths. Four great truths that are meant to help us to embrace the psychological task. Now we cover them over, and I would dare say sanitize them so much that we lose them. And we can all mouth the proper words. So I'll give you those words if that makes you feel more comfortable. Okay. So I'd like us to look at the Eucharist. In the Eucharist, there are four parts. The first one is the gathering rite. Okay? There's that wonderful language right there. But the gathering rite gives us the psychological task of learning and practicing how to be hospitable. What today we'd call either radical hospitality or wholehearted hospitality. And, of course, the template is meant to be how Jesus was hospitable. How he went wherever he was invited, and how he invited everyone to the table. The table of conversation, the table of ritual, the table of presence, the table of healing, the table of the great meal, even his betrayer. Both of them. Are we getting any better at the ways we're hospitable to all people? I was privileged on Monday night to be a part of a wonderful prayer service at Loyola Marymount University, where we had three different major traditions represented, praying for the repose of the soul of those who were killed in New Zealand at the different centers of worship, and also praying for their families and friends, the community, and those who were recovering from their injuries. But what struck me, and it probably was just me, is even in that wonderful opportunity environment, how many words we used. It was like we're using words to keep away the pain, to separate us. And of course, we had the Iman Kam, then the rabbi, then the priest. We had lay people. And it was like, it's a lot of words. But you know, when people are truly in pain, they don't use a lot of words. It's more actions. Screaming, stomping, throwing, holding themselves, rocking. I'm wondering if what we're missing in being hospitable to each other is to ask whoever comes to us, how can I be of service to you? What do you need? Can you tell me where the bathrooms are? Sure, right over here. Where are the cookies? Right over here. Okay. You know, I can't hear so well. Can I get a seat up near the front? Sure. Okay. So here's a true story of hospitality. This happened in the 60s. This was during the days when young people were beginning to come barefoot wherever they went, torn t-shirts and torn pants. And so this particular parish decided they were a bit progressive and they were going to try and reach out to the local college campus. And they posted all these signs, please come and worship with us. Well, the first 3 weeks, nobody from the college came. And then the following week, sure enough, there was a lone college student that came. He came barefoot. His pants were torn, his t-shirt was a bit torn, and he had long hair. And he walked in from the back of the church. And as he's walking slowly, looking from right to left to see if anybody would move. Nobody moved to let him in. He walked all the way to the front, and he sat down on the floor in front of the first pew. This older gentleman, way from the back, saw what he did. And he slowly got up and he walked with great effort. He had a cane. All the way to the front, looked down at the young man, smiled, put his cane aside and plopped down right next to him. Now, who in that church was the minister of hospitality? When the pastor came out and it was time for the homily, he said, pointing to these two, "This is this morning's homily." Everybody was grateful because Mass ended quicker. The second part of the Eucharist is the Word. The Word embedded in it is all the summary of the sacred scriptures. It's all about conflict resolution. How do we listen to each other? How do we tell the story? How do we respond to it? And let's face it, as we listen to the scriptures, resolution isn't always there. We read the Psalms. We have every human emotion there. And yet, embedded in this Word, that's why we're told to read and to study and to pray and to discuss the Word, so that we find ways and means to resolve our conflicts, to move from apology and forgiveness to reconciliation and restoration. That's the proper Christian movement. Apology, forgiveness, reconciliation, restoration. Many of us stop at the first one and wonder, how come I still feel so horrible? How come nothing's changed between you and me or between these two groups? So what if we were to expand this and say, now, looking at this teaching that's given to us through the practice of the Eucharist, how can we begin to bring this to our family dynamics, to our neighborhood dynamics, to our dynamics in our state, our nation, our world? So as I look over this room, we are all elders. We're all in the second half of life. It is our responsibility to walk into the midst of the fray and say to people one by one, what do you need? in order to come back into the fold. By fold, I mean to the family. How many family divisions there are? You know? People haven't talked to each other for years because there's some, as we say in Spanish, problemita, a very tiny problem that just blew out of proportion. Okay? Or in the neighborhood. You can get away with a lot just because of your gray hairs or white hairs. You can just say that. You know, I'm old, I'm going to die pretty soon, but why the hell aren't you being a part of our group? That's our role. As elders, we are to speak up and to invite the uninvited, the rejected, the marginalized, to come and to be with us. That's the liturgy of the word. The third one is the sacrament, the actual Eucharistic. Notice the action. Bread and wine, powerful symbols, are given to the presider. They are broken open. They are blessed, and then they're shared. This, my friends, is the beautiful, wonderful, central mystery of Christianity. And that is love. Education and love. It really angers me and hurts me that so many of our celibate, and I mean that underlined, celibate clergy keep talking about sex for all the wrong reasons. Especially talking to women and telling them what to do with their bodies. Telling people who can touch, who can't touch. That's so silly and immature. This mystery, from a mystical level, is what it's all about. How do we take the gift of our lives, our unique nature, our sexuality, our bodies, our urgings, our yearnings, all of it, how do we take it all? How do we break it open, the mystery? How do we bless it in God's name and then share it with each other and learn from each other? Because humanity, sexuality, gender identity, all of it is on a continuum. And God is present all along the continuum. This is all about love education. How do we grow in community, common unity? How do we grow in a unitive consciousness with each other? If we can't do it around the table of the Lord, it's not going to happen. This is where we say we believe in this. I remember a priest friend of mine who was really struggling, and rightfully so, with the clergy abuse scandal. He knew many of the priests personally, was angry about it, deeply saddened, ashamed, embarrassed, all the things that we've all experienced. And he was sharing this anger and frustration with me. And I said, what are you doing about it? He said, what do you mean, what am I doing about it? And I said, how are you responding to it? I said, you know, it'd be helpful for you to find a meaningful prayer practice where you can contain that pain so that it can become transformed. He said, what if you were able to use the Eucharistic table as a wonderful sacrificial metaphor, as a powerful symbol, and invite all the parts of you that need to be invited to that table? So I said, what are some things you like about yourself? He started naming them. What are some things you don't like about yourself? Started naming those. I said, now picture in your prayer those different parts of you around the table. Well, about 6 months later, we met, and I said, well, how's that prayer going? And he says, oh, man. He says, it's been very helpful, thank you. And very meaningful. And we met a few months later, and I said, still going good? He goes, well, actually, it's not a table anymore. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, it's a whole hall. He said, you know, Jim, he said, you got me started in something that really tore me up. Here, as I began to bring this into my imagination and prayer, I thought I'd only see all the good things, but God kept showing me all the things that were unfinished, unresolved. And you know, as a result of that imaginal prayer, this man became more compassionate, more forgiving, especially with those that he didn't like, those he disagreed with. So how are you educating yourself in the way of love, beginning with your imagination, which is also the repository of the way we judge people? And the last part, the sending forth rite. This is where Pope Francis has spent a lot of energy and time. For us as Christians, it's not just worship. It's worship and service. Notice the clergy person does not say, wasn't that a great service? Now sit down. We're going to have coffee and donuts right here in the church. Stay as long as you want. No, you never told that. See, now go on, get out of here. Go out and become Eucharist in the world. This, in one word, is all about service. How are you giving your life away? How are you in service to something greater than you? How do you recognize that Christ is within you and Christ yearns to be shared with all those you come in contact with? And it will be shared in different ways. How it's shared is up to you. So let's turn to a theologian named Ilya Delio. She said it this way: we must constantly evolve and forge new relationships of love that include the earth, all peoples, all religions, all plants and galaxies. This is the Christ Project. This is the Christ Project. Why St. Paul says that all of creation groans in agony until it's complete. My friends, what Mirabai is pointing out so beautifully in her stories and the unpacking of her own life, the love education that she has gleaned, and how to be hospitable and how to serve, is that we are unity as God is unity. We must awake to this reality. This is the mystical path and purpose. This is why nationalism is so limited, why tribalism no longer works, and why we're called to a unity not only of consciousness, but a unity of presence. So what spiritual practices can help you in this awakening process? Recognizing it's no longer just about you as an individual, but you and your relationships. Mirabai calls this the interspiritual quest. This time of a collective awakening is a personal invitation from the Creator for you to step deeply into the process. So I have a handout here that we can work with together. I love the many different practices that she's recommending, and I'd like to expand it to open it up a bit for you so that we can look at this. So if you turn to the page that talks about consciousness, I just want to quickly go through this. We are born into a simple consciousness where it's all true. It's all true. It's equally true. It's what we call believing in a literal reality. This is summarized for us in the sacred writings of the Jewish scriptures called the Torah. Looks like you're going to have to share if you don't mind. So this becomes the container, and the scriptural story that really allows this to become real for us is the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. This is the time and the place where we seek out answers to make us feel comfortable. Now, this is a necessary place to begin. This is a place where children begin, where uneducated people begin. This is where we begin to learn the stories from Scripture and why storytelling is a part of every religion. Okay, so that's simple consciousness. About the age of 7 to 9, life kicks us out of this simple consciousness. We begin to realize that not everything is equally true. We can get kicked out of this sooner if we've been traumatized, if we've been molested, if we've been in a major accident, or someone that is very close to us is harmed in some great way or dies, leaves us in life. Then we can dip into this even sooner. For example, the two women I shared with that were at this particular school of spiritual direction. So one way to understand this is a wonderful story of a little girl whose mother was a career woman, single mother, and she lost her first tooth, and her mother told the story of the tooth fairy. And she's so excited, not only that there is such a thing as a tooth fairy, but wow, she's going to get money for her tooth. So from morning until that night when she's going to put on her pillow, she was pestering her mom all day long, on the phone, texting, etc., etc. Her mom came home from work. She was exhausted. She did all the things that moms need to do to get her little daughter ready for bed. Told her a story, brought her a drink of water. But by the fifth time when she came to her bedroom, she'd had it. So she turns on the light when her daughter had called her from her room. She's all right. She says, I'm going to tell you the truth. There is no tooth fairy. See, I see so many of you doing that reaction, rightfully so. And then the little girl looks at the ceiling and says, oh, I get it. No tooth fairy, no Easter bunny, no Santa Claus, no Jesus, no Mary. That's literal consciousness. It's all equal. And why you know as parents and grandparents should be very careful about when to introduce them into complex consciousness. But if you are aware, you'll know when it happens. You'll know when it happens. Complex consciousness is when you finally make friends with the gray in life. It's not all black and white. This is where the prophetic literature comes from. Yes, this is true, but this is also true. So the story in the Jewish scriptures is the Exodus. This is the story of a people who are trapped by their own awareness. They keep walking in circles. They didn't get lost because Moses didn't bring a map, or he didn't ask his wife for directions. That's not why. They are lost in their own addiction to their thought process. The same thing over and over again for many, many years. This is where we spend much of our life. As Eckhart Tolle says, about 89% of our thoughts are negative and repetitive, therefore useless. So this is the stage of our life where we're interested in the contents. And we begin to enjoy the questions. And we have lots of them. This is where we call the area of the sacrament. The mediating ways of experiencing God through creation, through one another. Where symbols begin to take on such precious meaning for us. Where we begin to be interested in dreams and tending them and caring for them. Where we once again reclaim ritual making as a creative healing process in our life. Every once in a while, grace pulls us over into an awakened consciousness. It is light that kicks us into complex consciousness, but grace pulls us, invites us, draws us in an awakened consciousness. This is the place where we reclaim a simple consciousness. But the difference is there's a depth to it. It's four-dimensional, not one- or two-dimensional. This is why the wisdom literature is the most developed literature in the Hebrew scriptures. Think of the story of Job. Okay? Think of the story of so many of the wise individuals and their insights. So the metaphor comes from the Christian scriptures, and that is the kingdom of God. The mysterious kingdom of God, where God reigns. And that, notice the metaphors that Jesus used to describe it. They're very, very small and insignificant, but they have a great and deep and wonderful influence. This is where you experience, not just learn, that everything belongs. It's about union, and you find this in the silence of your heart, where paradox and ambiguity are a deep, important part of reality and of your life, and where your own imagination comes alive in an ever-deepening way. So how might we work with the Creator in developing, growing, would be called a daily mysticism? First one, I've alluded to each of these, I'm just calling them out, and I'm packing them more for you, is letting go, surrendering. Allowing yourself to be dissolved in God. To trusting that God will be there, as God always is there. And this is the way, the only way. And sometimes this is where we have our greatest breakthroughs. When we have tried everything and nothing works, and then you hear about all these, quote, testimonies. You say, well, then I just said, okay, God, I give up. And look what happened. That's what we're talking about. Maybe you like the word giving up better. But if we finally say, you know, my ego just can't handle this. I can't figure this out. It's bigger than me. This is yours, God. Secondly, being in the now. Being in the now. The Buddhists call this practicing mindfulness. Just being mindful of your breath, this person in front of you, the temperature of your body, particular ache in your body, particular look in the creation. Just being attuned to that. Third, experiencing deep gratitude. The gratitude for all that is, that somehow or another, light and darkness do fit together. Tragedy and triumph are part of the same mystery. Male and female, part of the same mystery. Why? I have no idea. You can ask the Creator when you stand before the Creator. But that, trying to figure it out, is bigger than all of us. But to experience it, that's our task. Fourth, a greater openness to passion and awe. Perhaps you might want to put yourself in that pathway. Go up and look at the poppies. Stand before the ocean. One man who was going through deep depression, was under doctor's care and medicated, felt prompted after work one day to just go out in his business clothes and go to the ocean. So he drove from work, parked his car, got out, walked through the sand in his shoes, and walked in the ocean, up to his neck. So the waves were coming and going. He just stood there for 45 minutes. At the end of 45 minutes, he noticed the depression was gone. He walked out of the ocean and never came back. Is that the ocean acted like a beautiful, loving embrace, like a sponge just leaching it all out. Creation is our friend. You know, having lived here, it can be strong and powerful and destructive. But in that symbol, what is God inviting from you and interacting with you through that powerful imagery? Fifth, living the symbolic life consciously. I say this to you with all the love of my heart. And that is, why do you have so much stuff in your homes? At this stage in your life, the only stuff you should keep is that which has deep, I mean that, deep meaning for you. Deep meaning. Get rid of all the other stuff. In other words, you are simplifying yourself to let you know these objects still have energy for you. The Native Americans every year would have a potlatch where they'd bring out items each individual no longer need and they'd put it in a pile. And you would get to pick one because you felt the energy of this object belonged to you. And then that person who was the previous owner would come and tell you what it meant to them. Instead, we have things called garage sales. Or on book. Okay. Oh, I thought you said I had an hour. Oh, I'm looking at my watch. I have 3 more minutes. Okay, thanks. So to recognize that this is how we're to live our life consciously. So seeking and maintaining a simple perspective is not a simplistic perspective. It's recognizing the deeper truth. Seventh is living with a both and perspective. And that means, can you hold this and that? There's a part of me that's complete and a part of me that's incomplete. I like this, I don't like that. Can you sit with that and honor both and not be totally given to one side or the other? And certainly silence as our friend. In silence, all that you need to face comes up. Comes up and helps you to look at what needs to be resolved in the presence of love. And then an act of service to the poor. You may say, well, I'm too old for that. I don't have time, enough energy. A friend of mine who's 74, she goes to the local convalescent home and she's chosen 3 different women that she meets with every week. And the gift she gives them is just to sit and listen to them. 2 of them are now approaching death. And yet, she won't leave their side. That's the gift she's giving. She said, I can't do much more, but I can do that. What can you do? Because to serve the poor isn't just for them. It's about being in service to our own powerlessness, our own impoverishment. And finally, living with a contemplative stance towards reality. Observing whatever is without judgment, letting it be. Whether it's individually or collectively. So what Mirabai is saying, in summary form, by her own words, is that we need to be a part of some sort of Trinitarian approach to life through whatever tradition you choose. To choose a meditative practice, to choose a relationship practice, and to choose a social action practice. When we do this, we experience what this last mystic is talking about. St. John of the Cross. It's called, I Cobbled Their Boots. How could I love my fellow men who tortured me? One night, I was dragged into a room and beaten near death with their shoes, striking me hundreds of times in the face, scarring me forever. I cried out to God for help until I fainted. That night, in a dream more real than this world, a strap from the Christ sandal fell from my bleeding mouth. And I looked at him, and he was weeping, and spoke, I cobbled their boots. How sorry I am. What moves all things is God. This is the mystical way, and why, with John's words, you can see why they're often called crazy. This is when Jesus said, love your enemies. It's a full circle, as the native peoples would teach us. How do we do it? We come to ourself, and in coming to ourself, we find God. God bless you.